This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their perspectives and stories. Today, we'll hear about how California farming has been affected by COVID-19.
The biggest day-to-day impact that we've seen is lack of PPE, of the personal protective equipment.
And although usually a seaside tourist destination, Morro Bay is having to tell visitors to stay away.
When there are a lot of people here, a lot of money being spent at the trinket shop, restaurants, hotels, that's what pays for police and fire. That's what pays for Harbor Patrol.
Those stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, June 1st, 2020. I'm Carol Tangeman. Emergency relief for undocumented immigrants recently became available in California, but demand outweighs the supply of cash. For years, advocates had been fighting to shore up the economic safety net for these workers, many of whom are in essential industries. Now, they say more assistance is crucial. KAZU's Erica Mahoney reports.
Imagine choosing between food or soap. That's a reality for a mom in Salinas who I recently spoke with via Zoom. She says the pandemic has affected her tremendously.
Emotionally, you have that fear, but monetarily as well, because we're working very few hours, and so right now our expenses are more than what I can afford.
We're not using her name because she's undocumented. She works in agriculture, mainly in the strawberry fields.
Trato de cubrirme y tener este distanciamiento social en el trabajo.
I try to protect myself and practice social distancing at work, but I'm afraid all the time. But I have to work.
She makes around $12 or $13 an hour, but recently her hours have been cut in half.
We have essential workers in our community that do not have a safety net.
Tim McManus is an organizer with the Industrial Areas Foundation, a network of faith and community-based groups that's working to help undocumented immigrants during this crisis. Nearly 1 in 10 workers in the state is undocumented, according to the Public Policy Institute of California. In April, Governor Gavin Newsom allocated $75 million in emergency assistance to undocumented immigrants. But they still don't qualify for the federal stimulus checks and can't apply for unemployment insurance. They are also barred from the state's tax credit program for low-income workers.
Governor Newsom has come out many times to talk about the value of the immigrant community, a recognition that the undocumented are part of California and deserve to be part of the California dream. And this is contradictory to leaving people out of that tax break.
It's called the Earned Income Tax Credit and results in a cash rebate to low-income workers. Depending on how much you make and how many children you have, you could qualify for a couple $100s or nearly $3,000. The program started in 2015 in California and is modeled after a federal one. But you must have a Social Security number to apply. Many undocumented workers file taxes using a taxpayer ID number. If those taxpayers could qualify for the Earned Income Tax Credit, it would benefit more than 600,000 people. That's according to the California Immigrant Policy Center.
This is something that has been talked about before, and there hasn't really been the political will to finish it off and make it happen.
A bill to expand the program passed the Assembly last year. But despite supporters' hopes, funding was not included in Governor Newsom's latest budget. H.D. Palmer is deputy director for the State Department of Finance.
The fiscal reality of what we have to deal with in closing a budget gap now that's more than $54 billion is something that constrains our ability to expand existing programs, let alone start new ones.
Also absent in the budget, funding for a plan to expand health care coverage for undocumented immigrants over the age of 65. Money for schools and reducing homelessness has been cut. State Senator Ana Caballero, whose district includes the Salinas Valley, has supported extending California's Earned Income Tax Credit. She says the challenge in promoting this assistance is timing.
So it hurts me to see people assume that if we don't do it, that we don't really care, because we do.
She says once the economy starts to pick back up, the legislature will go back and see what they can add in.
It's going to be a matter of trying to figure out what's happening in the economy And what are the things we absolutely have to do to keep people safe?
Immigrant advocates say they're not giving up, especially now. The pandemic has underscored the importance of all essential workers. Tim McManus with the Industrial Areas Foundation says this fight is about recognition through policy and putting money in people's pockets.
So forgetting about what you think about fairness or justice or morality, this is an economic stimulus. We're going to recover stronger if all of California can land back on their feet sooner.
For now, amid the state's stalled economy, it appears undocumented workers will have to wait. The mom we met in the beginning of this story says she's applied for California's emergency cash payments for undocumented immigrants, but has not yet heard back.
That was Erica Mahoney reporting in Monterey County. The California Nanosystems Institute at UC Santa Barbara is a place where engineers, scientists, and students make prototypes for their projects, often using 3D printers. As Beth Thornton reports, the lab has lately switched to making face shields for healthcare workers.
When UCSB moved to online learning and students went home due to the pandemic, the once busy lab on campus was empty. But Dave Boffman says he kept getting articles from fellow UCSB faculty about using 3D printers to make personal protective equipment, or PPE. Inspired by the possibilities, he asked the UC administration for permission to use the lab for that purpose.
UC has a threefold mission of teaching, research, and community service, and making PPE for, you know, the community certainly fit within that. I got nothing but encouragement.
Bothman's career as an engineer has focused on designing and building scientific instruments. This was his first foray into healthcare, so he relied on existing patterns. The shields fit like a visor with a clear plastic piece worn over safety glasses and masks.
So that a patient that's spreading virus, a lot of that will be intercepted by the face shield.
Boffman and an assistant traded off keeping the 3D printers running.
We could make about 30 per day if we ran the printers all night, all day and all night.
Later in March, Boffman joined a group of UCSB researchers and local businesses to plan for the PPE needs for Santa Barbara Cottage Health. Given what was happening in other places, Boffman says Cottage Health requested 10,000 face shields as well as other PPE for healthcare workers. And that's when he began collaborating with other local companies, from printing shops to biomedical manufacturers, even Moxie, the Children's Science Museum, that also had the tools to make face shields. Fortunately, Santa Barbara to date has not been overwhelmed, and Boffman says Cottage Health received the face shields they need. This allowed the group to donate a large quantity for distribution to the wider community.
These were in turn donated to the Santa Barbara Foundation with the hopes that we would go out and distribute these to organizations, facilities within the community, which needed them the most.
That's Stephanie Robertson with the Santa Barbara Foundation. She coordinates distribution of the face shields to healthcare providers and nonprofits. She says she started by placing calls to other area medical providers like Marion, Lompoc, and Sansom.
We've also provided shields to long-term nursing facilities and residential care facilities.
Robertson has delivered thousands of face shields within Santa Barbara County, and she says there are still some available. As for the summer, Boffman says he and others will be there if more face shields are needed. Reporting for KCBX News, I'm Beth Thornton in Santa Barbara.
Small farms are at the heart of Central California's rich agricultural industry, but the challenges facing these operations are numerous. KVPR's Kathleen Schock checked in with three Fresno County farmers about the most recent obstacle they are facing, COVID-19. She spoke with grape and raisin farmer Stephen Cardoza, Chu Lee of Lee's One Fortune Farm, and Will Scott Jr., who, in addition to running Scott Family Farms, is also the president of the African American Farmers of California. Here's Kathleen Schock.
So I'd like to start with a roundtable. If you could all just briefly tell us what you grow and how your life on the farm has changed as a result of COVID-19. Will, we'll go ahead and start with you.
Well, in a way, the way it's affected me is the fact that it has to do with the season. I think that's present with a lot of small farmers in that, you know, when you limit, say, water, or you limit toilet paper, they also limit seeds. I couldn't get the seeds that I required in order for me to farm. But there's some adjustment that can be made. You know, it tells me that there's some things else I should be doing in order to make myself, you know, prepare for farming.
So how did you adapt to this lack of access to seeds?
Well, you know, this thing gives you a chance to also be in quarantine. It gives you a chance to reflect. And I had the time to kind of reassess where I'm at in farming, you know, what I need to do to be more efficient and also to meet some of the demands that's being required, you know, with this pandemic. So I've had a chance to think about it and also have to come up with some new ways of doing things, you know, which has been a blessing, I guess, in order to have the time to rethink some things.
Stephen, let's shift to you. How has COVID-19 changed life on your farm?
So we grow organic raisin grapes, and the biggest day-to-day impact that we've seen is lack of PPE, of the personal protective equipment. I've been having a really hard time getting masks and protective suits to wear. I wear one myself, and my employees wear when we apply sulfur dust, and then we do several nutrient applications through our spray rigs as well, and both of these require PPE. So I've had to adjust my applications and try to consolidate how many times I have people going out in the field that require this PPE, because I don't know the time frame of when I'm going to be able to acquire more.
And Chu, are you experiencing similar things?
Yeah, I'm so similar thing, except that my situation is that I'm a farmer market grower. So on this COVID-19, it's pretty effective a lot of our farmer market thing, because the control and then the disease that is out there. So a lot of control, and then it's hurting us because what we grow, then we cannot go out there and sell it. Yeah, that's so. It's just similar, except that I'm different from the other two growers because I'm a farmer market grower, and then that hurt us a lot too.
You know, the impact of COVID-19, I would imagine, is different for smaller farms compared to the more corporate agricultural operations. Will, can you just talk about, as a small farmer, how the situation, I think you mentioned it a bit before, but how are you doing?
Well, I'm doing pretty good because, like I said, having a chance to reassess, and I think Mr. Chu kind of hit it too, because I rely on the farmer's market also. So when you are denied that access, then that means you have to come up with other means of getting to the consumer, in which we should do. You know, a farmer should get as close to the consumer as possible in order for him to get an equitable return on his, his labor. So I've had to rethink some things too, you know, and I think that I'm a senior citizen, so I'm not into this high tech stuff that's going on now, but I have grandkids who are in there. So, you know, this Instagram and these Facebook and stuff like that forces me to rely on that, because, you know, within 5 minutes, you know, they can have access to 100 people as far as being able to reach customers. So it has had me to, I guess it's kind of more or less urged me to come into the new way of doing things. And it's kind of frustrating. Like now I'm not going to the farmer's market. So, but it gave me a chance to prepare, for getting in some other aspects of the business.
And what have you come up with? What are the alternatives that you found to reach your customers?
Well, I have a lot of people, you know, I kind of favor black-eyed peas and purple peas. So, and I guess there must have been a shortage last year. I didn't have enough of it. So when your name gets out there that you grow black-eyed peas, then you get calls from one end of the state to the other. So that forces you to either come up with the supply or you try to, you know, get in to maximize, you know, your effort on your land. So that has caused me to, you know, step up to that point, whereas that I reach out to, you know, not only my grandkids as far as getting customers, but also to other entities in the community so that we can push this product to the people who need them, you know.
And Chu, I point the same question to you. How are you getting your product in the hands of people who need it?
Well, we do get a lot, but except that when we go to a market, they still the town that we go, they have a control of it. The same thing like all the market or the store around here. We have to do the 6 foot apart so that people cannot touch your produce. So there's a lot of control. And even though we have our produce go out there, there are people scared coming out to buy our produce too. So that's a lot of things that we cannot do. And then we do have it, but then we cannot do it too.
So Stephen, earlier you mentioned that you were struggling to find PPE for your farm workers and yourself. What kind of local, state, federal support have you received, and is it enough?
As far as PPE goes, the county provided, well, they called the other day and said that they would have some masks for us. We went and picked them up, and they were surgical masks. So they really don't present any use on the farm whatsoever. So, I mean, I appreciate the effort, but I can't. I'm not going to give my employee a surgical mask and then have them go dump a bag of sulfur in the back of a tank. So that's been a problem. And as far as the government's efforts to help assist growers like myself in this situation, we've been able to take advantage of some of the assistance programs, the economic injury disaster loan in particular, and the paycheck protection program. But something that Will mentioned earlier and that I can definitely relate to, given I'm taking over the business from my father, is that what I had to do to obtain this assistance is definitely not something that he would have been capable of doing on his own. There are so many hoops to jump through, files that you need to digitize, just navigating the applications and understanding the verbiage, that the way that they're trying to get this information from you is so just it's a mess. And very difficult to answer correctly and provide all the information that they need. And then the time that you need to do it is such a narrow window that you have maybe hours to submit your application before it closes for funding. So I've committed days of my, like normally that I'd be out working, I've committed just trying to do these applications. And luckily I've been successful, but it's really unrealistic to expect, especially smaller growers that don't have several full-time employees that they can delegate tasks to be able to jump through these hoops to obtain the assistance that they so desperately need.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Valley Edition host Kathleen Schock is speaking with three Fresno County farmers, grape and raisin farmer Stephen Cardoza, Chu Lee of Lee's One Fortune Farm, and Will Scott Jr. of Scott Family Farms. Let's get back to the conversation.
Will, you have done a lot of work to educate young people about the career opportunities available in agriculture. Given the perspective you have and your many years running a farm, I'm wondering if there are long-term changes that you see coming for small farms as a result of this experience.
Yeah, I like to be optimistic about it, but it's tough being a small farmer, you know, because first of all, it's like this pandemic. With this pandemic comes a lot of rules, a lot of regulations. Well, so does in farming. Farming has a lot of rules and regulations. You know, some people want clean air. They want clean water and stuff like that. So they put regulation in that's actually, to me, without any forethought as to what would be the collateral damage on the least of us, you know, and that being the small farmer. So, you know, we have to be... I guess to get economic equity is that we have to be careful who we injure in these things, you know, and when we put these regulations into effect, who is going to be hurt the worst. Now, in small farmers, and I think Stephen alluded to it too, is that the government is supposed to be, to me, user-friendly. That means that when they came out with these regulations, they should be understandable to us, and we should be able to understand them. And like I said, we should be given time to absorb it. And most time, we have not been able to do it because it's something that came out, and you have to react instantly, you know, and we can't do that because, as you know, a farmer should be doing what he does best. That's farming. Well, now we know, too, is that a small farmer, I find out, too, is that farming is a business. You know, you just can't grow it, and that's it. You're going to have to take care of the financial aspect of it, too, and be a business if you plan on being in business for any length of time. So I think that a lot of entities are stepping up, and I think this pandemic is somewhat brought a lot of people together. We have to think that in reality that we are in this mess together, so therefore we need to help one another. And I think that is kind of shine the light on it. You know, and I know the media is certainly did their part on it, is that we really need to be able to help each other. It's like the large farmers, you know, with the seed deals. I'm sure they didn't go through what I went through to get seeds in our future in farming, because they already had things in place to cover things like this. And a lot of times we farmers, you know, we go on from day to day. The crop that we have in the field is the expense for the next crop, you know, and hopefully we on the end, we come out with some money for us to put in our pocket to pay our other bills. But no, this has been a learning experience for me, is that if the small farmers to maintain or sustain them, you know, the programs that they have, some of them are magnificent. Even this little stimulus program they give too, that helped a little bit, you know. But I think too is that we have to also realize too is that the small farmer is a very important to our civilization. This whole thing started with small farmers. Therefore, we should not allow that entity to disappear, and it is. But not to go any further, but no, this has been a learning experience, and I think that the small farmers, my hat goes out to them, is that they still, and that because we have to eat. And I think this pandemic tells us, too, is that you need to know where your food's coming from, because we need food security. We are inundated with things that come to this country we have no remedy for. So it kind of give us some kind of protection as far as what are we eating. That's my concept of it. And, I, you know, like I said, I appreciate, you know, the media coming out and finding out what is happening to the small farmer. You know, before they just take us for granted. They just, you know, we're invisible people, you know. But even though we provide a very valuable function to the agriculture industry, you know, as far as being able to provide those things that the big farmer is not, you know, that he's not providing.
Well, I think your point about this pandemic being a reminder to all of us that we need to know where our food comes from is a really important point. And I wonder, maybe Chu, you could weigh in on this. Do you think this crisis could lead to an increased interest in farmers markets or community supported agriculture?
That's the question. Yeah, that's a lot of things. Yeah, this pandemic will let people know that it's safe, that a lot of growth like us is just on the farm to the hand of the people instead of from some like warehouse stuff like that. But yeah, this pandemic do help us a lot and educate a lot of customers too.
Stephen, and I'm going to actually ask this question of all of you, but Stephen, I'm going to start with you. What can we do as a community to support you?
I think the consumer has the ability to support us and vote with their purchasing dollar. So you can help try to support the industries that need it, that you are passionate about, that hopefully people become more aware, like Will was mentioning, what you were mentioning, of local growers, and support them directly and make an effort to make sure that your purchasing dollar is going directly to people within your community. I feel like that's probably the one piece that everybody listening and everybody in the community has the capability of offering to their local growers.
Well, do you concur, or do you have other thoughts?
No, I agree with him 100%. What we need to do is that, like I said, that you are what you eat. And I think too, my opinion is that if you eat stuff that's in your environment, it builds up your immune system, protect you for whatever comes into that environment. You know, it protects you. So, you know, buying, you know, and helping the small farmer, you know, another thing too is that it's like the vegetable that you grow. You know, if you want to, have you ever tasted a vine ripe tomato where you picked it out when it really matured and you compared it to one you bought somewhere else? There's a vast difference in that, you know. So therefore, you know, a lot of young people now, you know, they have the mindset, you know, they want to know where their food comes from because they're more intelligent. So with the meter comes up too, we can educate them too, is that these are things that you should be eating. You know, we know what we eat that will give us the strength we need and also build up our immune system. So the reality of it is that the young people, they're there, but like I said, speaking from African American standpoint too, is that there's a legacy about farming. You know, so we don't use the word farming. We use agriculture, you know, because that has a better twang to it, you know. But I think that we have to have somebody. Someone has to replace me. You know, I'm 80 years old, so somebody has to replace me on to grow this food because I want to continue to eat also. So we have to have young people in, but we have to bring them in on the deal that not only can they make money in it, but also that they are fulfilling some of the destiny as far as taking care of senior citizens and our young people. But it's coming, you know, and I think this pandemic is really opening eyes to a lot of people. As you know now, is that we try to get more people involved in the farming. But I've heard that more people are now, they're starting their own a little gardens in their home, you know, utilizing the space that they have at home. And this is a good thing, too, because I think that young people, they need to know how to grow this food, you know. Most of them under the impression that it's just in the supermarket. I don't know how it got there. I don't know how it grow. You whether it grow on top of the ground or below the ground, but it's there. But, yeah, and we need to meet it to educate people, you know, to this effect. And I think that, you know, Valley, what you're doing is very important.
Well, and I think what you're doing is very important as well. Chu, can you just give us your quick thoughts on what we can all do to support you?
Yeah, a lot of things that both of the farmers already saying, but yeah, I say the same thing. It's just that eat fresh and from the farm fresh to the table is better. But a lot of things is that, yeah, we need a lot of community to help us with the farmer market that's out there. Like the partner just said, done. Yeah, out there in the warehouse or the market, you never know what it's coming from. So, like for us, like farmer market here, it's from fresh from the farm to the table, and it's fresh. They know that. So, yeah, a lot of things they have been saying. Yeah, so that's the thing is that to tell a lot of community to help out because the farmer market is just from bringing from fresh to the table.
Well, Stephen Cardoza, Chu Lee, Will Scott Jr., thank you so much for being with us today and sharing your stories.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
That was Kathleen Schock in a recent segment aired on KVPR's Valley Edition. Working Lunch. It's a weekly Facebook Live conversation between the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce and someone in the community doing interesting or innovative work. Today, we'll hear from Wendy Wendt, the director of First Five Slow County.
Hello, and welcome to Working Lunch, the Slow Chamber's weekly series where we get to sit down with key community leaders and start feeling a little more connected in these isolating times. I'm Jim D'Antona, President and CEO of the Slow Chamber, and today you'll get to learn a little bit more about a person that's leading big changes in our community, Wendy Wendt, the executive director of First Five Slow County. First Five is an independent public agency created in 1998 by California's Proposition 10, which added a 50-cent tax on tobacco products. This revenue provides a dedicated source of funding for programs that serve children from prenatal development through age 5 and their families. From health to education to family support, their work intersects all aspects of life for children ages 0 to 5. Since she took the helm at First Five in 2014, Wendy has been leading the charge in growing awareness for the challenges facing children and their families in San Luis Obispo, and has collectively brought government, business, and childcare providers together to collaborate on solutions that help not only local families, but also our economy. We will be talking about what a family-friendly workplace looks like in a post-pandemic world, the myriad of initiatives First Five has contributed to in just the past few weeks, and get her perspective on the outlook for children and families. I'm so looking forward to talking to Wendy about all of the amazing work she and her team are doing. Thank you so much for being here, Wendy.
So glad to be here with you.
Things are loosening up and more businesses are beginning to open and reopen. How have childcare centers and preschools been navigating these challenges? Because they're absolutely necessary while school's out and people are trying to return to work.
There were some really incredible efforts in the beginning stages of the shelter in place to keep some centers and some family childcare homes open, and yet the demand was actually lower than you might expect given the need. People were just kind of functioning the best they could and keeping their kids at home when at all possible. Now that we've moved into phase two of the reopening plan, childcare centers technically are allowed to start accepting families who fall outside the sort of traditional essential worker category. However, I know our public health director and others have said if families are at all able to continue to find arrangements outside of congregate care, that's good, while childcare centers mobilize to answer the call, reopen, and do it in a way that's safe. And as you can imagine, just like with the restaurant industry, hotel, and different sectors, there are a number of pretty significant rules in place for childcare centers and family childcare homes to open in the new setup we have. So they're all working really hard and can't wait to see their kids and bring families back into their care, but they want to do it responsibly and make sure that the community feels safe and that they feel safe.
Now, potentially with a reduced capacity, have you heard of ways that we're maybe going to break, or are we just starting to kind of tread into this water?
Well, you're asking a really critical question. And much like the restaurant industry, as a way to make sure that social distancing is possible in the context of childcare centers, the ratios have been shrunk. So if 20 children used to be allowed into, say, a classroom setting, now it's down to 10. I might not have the numbers exactly right, but you get the idea. It's being contracted by a significant margin. And so that means that childcare centers have to function with the same, potentially close to the same budget, but with much less in the way of revenue. We're not sure what's going to happen. I've seen some pretty dire predictions at the national level that the childcare sector could contract as much as 50% over the next period of time, just at the moment when, as you pointed out, our workforce is ready to, is mobilizing to go back to work and they need childcare. So demand is up and supply risks going down. And I think it's really important for our community leaders to lean in with our childcare professionals to try to weather the storm together in partnership in whatever ways we can.
Obviously, seeing the challenges in childcare, we've also seen some positives of businesses figuring out like what a family-friendly workplace is. And do you see that kind of in the post-COVID world?
Absolutely. To your point, businesses, employers, HR professionals are realizing, wow, some of this is really possible. We were forced into it, and now we're realizing that there's some real benefits. And I think it's created this culture shift within, again, certain sectors of the workforce. There are certain sectors where things like flexible scheduling and work from home just don't function well. But in those that do function well, I've been hearing from my colleagues in the HR world, wow, there's something to this. And shifting that culture from one of seat time and being at the office and clocking hours to more of a partnership between employers and working families where they're working together and it's more of a family of families culture.
You talked a little bit about the other things that First Five does, because obviously the business community, we're most familiar with your work as it intersects with working families and child.
Right.
But you really do so much more. Can you share some of the initiatives that have arisen?
Sure.
In response?
Absolutely, yeah. First Fives are charged not just with focusing on early learning, which kind of fits in the childcare conversation, but we're also charged with focusing on family strengthening and child health and development. The work around childcare, I see being both within early learning and family resiliency, because it's about helping families have the supports that they need, whether it's from their childcare provider or their employer or their doctor or their mental health provider, to help them be the best parents they can during those early years of life. So those are always the three pillars on which First Five agencies statewide sit. And during the pandemic, we've had both the honor and the challenge of working in all three of those areas. I'll just kind of touch on two other initiatives that have been top of mind during the pandemic. In the category of family resilience, we opted to activate additional first $5 during the crisis that we titled Emergency Response Funding. And we teamed up with the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County, and their Disaster Support Fund has been issuing weekly grants to nonprofits in the community that support basic needs of vulnerable families, families in vulnerable situations. So the food bank, the homeless shelter system, CAPSLO, Family Support Division, the Promotores Collaborative, et cetera. And so first $5 have been commingled with a disaster support fund. And in cases where organizations are supporting the needs of children, young children and families, our dollars are helping to be leveraged against the disaster support fund donation. And then as far as child health and development, we've been very involved in getting a new initiative mobilized called Help Me Grow, which is looking at early intervention and early developmental milestone supports, both with pediatricians and providers of services like speech and language, occupational physical therapy for young children who are facing developmental delays. And it's interesting, while parents are sheltering at home with their kids, they're spending a lot more time observing their developmental milestones, and they're very interested in getting more versed and more literate in what it means to support and reinforce and enhance your child's developmental progress through early childhood. So that's been an exciting partnership that we've maintained through the pandemic and will continue with Dr. Bravo's office and Community Health Centers of the Central Coast and a number of other organizations, Martha's Place, County Public Health, et cetera. So it's exciting. And we have not stopped that work during the pandemic.
You also are partnering with all these different groups and having your fingers in a lot of different places. And you were just about to kick off a partnership, I think, with the county, the city, and Cal Poly and the school district.
Yeah.
Where does that project stand?
Right. Well, so that's back to our original theme today, the childcare piece. You know, as you mentioned, it's been at least a couple years that community leaders, both in the public and private sector, have been raising their own awareness and knowledge about the challenges and opportunities to expand capacity in childcare. And some of our public sector leaders stepped in to a shared project about 6 to 8 months ago, and now we're just starting to activate it, and that is to commission a study of our childcare capacity in San Luis Obispo County, look for possible initiatives to move forward that would build the number of quality affordable opportunities for families to access childcare in this county. And, you know, as irony would have it, we were a little bit slow to get started on the project, but our team that's working on it, Cal Poly, the city, San Luis Coastal, Cal Poly, we all kind of patted ourselves on the back the other day. Well, it's a good thing we delayed it a little bit, because if we'd done this study and then the pandemic had hit, we would have had to start all over again. So it's the time is perfect, actually, to bring in some outside expertise and really take a good, deep look at this. We're excited.
Yeah, and you're getting a great example of what, you know, why it needs to be resilient right in this key, right as everybody's trying to come back. Wendy, thank you again for being with us today.
That was Wendy Wendt, the director of First Five SLO County. You can hear more Working Lunch conversations on the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce website. The city of Morro Bay is dependent on tax revenue from the tourist industry. For the first time in modern history, Morro Bay has been discouraging visitors and vacationers due to COVID-19. Correspondent Tom Wilmer talks with the city manager of Morro Bay, Scott Collins.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from the waterfront in Morro Bay, California. Come along and join us as we visit with Scott Collins, city manager of the city of Morro Bay. Hi, Scott.
Hey, sir.
So, here we are, strange days, strange times.
Hey, we're all stretched as thin as we are, can be to react to this crazy situation on so many different fronts. You know, we immediately sprung into action to help keep our community safe, working with the county, who's done an extraordinary job, in my opinion, of keeping the spread down. Our business community stepped up, and our regular citizens have stepped up by staying home. By doing that, though, it's created an economic tailspin for the entire world's economy and all the way down to Morro Bay.
You are, in a sense, like a business manager. You're the manager of the city, and you're dependent on revenue. Looking in from the outside, one of the primary sources of revenue for the city of Morro Bay is tourism.
Yeah, we depend and thrive upon a successful tourist season. Mm-hmm. We're heading into it. time-wise, it's going to look remarkably different than years past. The governor is talking about reopening along public health guidelines, but it's going to be socially distanced, mm-hmm. and it's not going to look the same. That being said, people are coming to town.
Whether you want them to come or
correct.
Not.
Correct. Yes. We don't get to turn that switch off.
Yeah.
We are a town that is used to receiving. We are not a town that is staffed or resourced to turn people away.
Right.
The state did not take the martial law approach, and so people are coming. Mm-hmm. You know, I think for 2 weeks, 4 weeks, we had really good compliance from visitors choosing not to go anywhere, and that patience wore thin. You know, you couple that with hot temperatures, people are flooding into cooler environs. That includes Pismo Beach, us, Avila, Cayucas, Cambria. We're all dealing with it. So it is a multifaceted issue. I think our community members, you know, their nerves are frayed from seeing the number of visitors, and they want something to happen. And we feel that frustration. I'm frustrated. I haven't left this town for 8 weeks. I know what that feels like. Yeah. I love being here, but you know, sometimes you got to get out, and mm-hmm. we're not doing that, but people are able to make their own personal choices. And as we all know, from the Valley to Morro Bay, there is a direct connection, historic and transportation wise, the beach, it's all there. It's an inexpensive trip
yep.
to come here. And so we,
and for a lot of people, yeah. second homes from the Valley.
Right. Yeah. So we're in a very weird place of encouraging people not to come, mm-hmm. which is something you never do as a tourist community. You never say don't come. It's
right.
always come. That's what we do. Mm-hmm. That's what our community, business community does. They
right.
cater to that. They understand that. But now we're in a totally different place where, yeah. okay, please don't come. You know, we're not the only one going through this, thankfully. So we have colleagues in Pismo and other places that I can call and talk to, because we're all sort of making our way through this. We're making it up as we go. As I've talked to some other city managers, you know, that being said, we've all trained for this mm-hmm. our entire careers. We just didn't know it. But this is really where we put our skills, our experiences, our education to the test, because we have to make it up as we go. And that includes working with our community and helping them understand what we're capable of doing and what we're not capable of doing. As I said, we're a community that's 10,000 people. And resource according to that. The number of police officers, firefighters, maintenance staff, engineers, planners is based upon a population of that size. And so when we have economic downfalls, our staffing follows that. It doesn't necessarily make sense, though, because when you hit these hard times is when people turn to government more than ever.
Where have you been able to tighten the belt?
Our budget is primarily personnel. So we've taken pay cuts. City Council waived their stipend, as the Planning Commission did the same thing. Our contracted folks, like our attorney and our project manager for the wastewater project, have all taken 10% cuts.
Pretty much across the board.
Yeah, and then we head into, you know, filling no vacant positions, no travel, no training. Mm-hmm. Basically looking at every single expense and saying, is this absolutely necessary?
Where okay. have you been able to eliminate?
Yeah, we've had to do that, unfortunately. We notified several employees, and it's painful because we're a city of about 90-plus full-time employees, mm-hmm. okay? And so I know each and every one of them. I know their personal lives, their dependency on these jobs, the amount of effort and passion they bring to the position and to serving our community. And so having to sit down with each of them to say, you know, I can't afford to keep you any longer is really hard. So we've had to look at things where we can tighten to have the least amount of effect and impact on public services. So we still preserve police and fire, but we've had to cut pretty much everywhere else. Mm-hmm. And again, those things will have some effect and impact on the community. It's just not as pronounced as others. So we have to make those strategic and very challenging and hard decisions. And we are feeling it maybe worse than others because we're tourist dependent. So that means hotel tax and sales tax.
So hotel tax, the TOT, yeah. is a huge income source for the city. Correct.
Yeah, it's probably about 20% of our general fund. Mm-hmm. And then the spinoffs from visitors is sales tax, you know, the gas station purchases, the restaurants, going to, you know, the retail shops, you know, the grocery stores, et cetera. I mean, mm-hmm. we really see our peak in spending in the summer months, mm-hmm. right? And again, we're heading into that, and it's going to look a lot different. We're trying to predict our budget based on something that hasn't happened for over 100 years. So, but our goal, overriding goal, again, from a internal standpoint is I want to preserve as many of the jobs as possible because these people do important work for the community. Once you lose one, it affects everything else. Secondarily, that we work with our federal and state legislators to get relief. And it sounds like there's hope on the front coming up for a bipartisan bill in Congress that would help backfill some revenue losses, which would be great, and then preserve, maybe bring back some of the people we've lost, or at least not have to cut more. That's really important. And, you know, business community is getting well served by the chamber, and the city's doing what we can to help limit the impacts.
How do you cross-pollinate and get on the same page with the Chamber of Commerce? Because their primary mission is different from yours.
Right. And I we've had good conversations over the last couple of years. We really strengthened our partnership to understand their needs and then them to understand our community's needs and the city needs, how we are intricately linked. You can't have one without the other. If we go too hard on taxes, if we go too hard on fees, that has an effect on the business community, which hurts them, which hurts us, right? So it's a reciprocal relationship. Now, especially in times where maybe folks aren't getting federal loans or grants, things that they absolutely need, we're trying to help reduce the burden by, hey, you know, hold on to that TOT payment. Use that as cash flow for the next couple months. Pay us back in August. Or if you're a lease front operator here, you know, don't pay us rent. Hold on to that money because you're going to need it. You're going to need it. And if we go too hard on that, if we say, no, you got to pay us now, well, guess what? They're going to go out of the business. They're not going to reopen. It's going to be vacant storefronts.
Let's talk a little deeper for a moment about the shops along the Embarcadero, because a lot of people don't realize that these shopkeepers don't own the shops.
Right.
City of Morro Bay owns the waterfront.
Yes. It's a fascinating, so one of the things I had to learn quickly when I moved here. So the state owns the dirt on the waterfront down the Embarcadero. And the county took it over after the war, and then when the city incorporated, we took it over from the county. So it's still owned by the state, but it's ours for all intents and purposes, and we lease that to leaseholders who have built properties, and then they have subtenants. So it's a very complicated relationship.
So that must be another primary source of revenue for the city of Morro
Bay. Right. Yeah. Again, when there are a lot of people here, a lot of money being spent in the trinket shops, the retail shops, the restaurants, the ice cream shops, coffee shops, hotels all on the waterfront. That's what pays for police and fire. That's what pays for Harbor Patrol, the things that make our quality of life, I would say, really strong in this community.
The city of Morro Bay, does it have a tourism department?
Yes, and unfortunately, that was one of the positions we had to eliminate because we can't market right now. People aren't supposed to do leisure travel right now. And if you look at the governor's reopening plan, leisure travel is further down the road than weeks. It's more like months. So, in fact, we can't market, so I can't justify that expense.
Right.
Now, that being said, when we're allowed to market months from now, whenever, we want to have as much money freed up. Like I said, managing a lot of different fronts, and it can be overwhelming at times, but I'm so lucky and fortunate to be here. Of all the places where to have to go through this, because every city manager in America and every mayor, council, is going through the same thing, right? Everybody, pretty much.
Yeah. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Correspondent Tom Wilmer is talking with the city manager of Morro Bay, Scott Collins.
We knew coming here that there were some pretty unique challenges with the wastewater project and doing a whole revamp of the general plan, and already had budget issues to contend with, but I've enjoyed every minute I've been here. This virus is, though, putting us to the test, and it's putting our community to the test. And I think the community's really shown they know what to do. They know how to shelter in place. Their frustrations about others not doing it is palpable, and I sympathize with that because I'm not leaving my town. Right. I'm only going out when I absolutely need to.
Well, I have to say, as I go to Miner's Hardware or whatever, if you didn't have a mask on, they're going to give you the stink eye, man.
Yes, there's a bit of the social shaming, right? I mean, there is no mask ordinance. The county health officer said, you know, it's recommended but not required. Mm-hmm. However, you know, you go into Albertsons or other, you know, grocery stores where it's mandated, it creates a sense of calm. So I totally understand both the psychology and the health side of that. And I wear a mask, you know, when I'm close to people. I feel like it's the appropriate thing to do.
Going forward, short term, What are you most excited about? What are you most positive about?
We are a very generous community, Morro Bay is, and just seeing how people are trying to work together to help each other, whether it's a school, Del Mar School, doing a elementary school, doing a drive, a rally through town to say hello to their students that they haven't been able to see all year, or, you know, firefighters calling our elderly population to see how they're doing, checking in, and then people donating their money and time to help that effort. I'm really just so impressed with that. And there's so many other stories beyond that. And, you know, somebody donated their stimulus check to the city. Can you believe that?
Wow.
They said, you know, you guys are having a hard time to me, so I'm going to give you my stimulus check. It just boggles my mind, the fact that people have that sense of ownership. I'm encouraged by that. Mm-hmm. I think that'll bode well for us. There's a story about the last pandemic, and I think it ran in the New York Times. Anyways, the cities that were resilient and the cities that did the right thing, social distancing, were the ones who sprung back quicker and had more lasting power. And I think Morro Bay is primed for that. Now, I don't fool myself to think that it may not come back again. And so we're very cautious. Mm-hmm. And I think we're served well by our governor in terms of public health and the county as well. Looking into the future, if we have to go back into this, are people going to be as willing to do the right thing? We don't know. Yeah. That's one of the great unknowns at this time.
Scott Collins, City Manager, City of Morro Bay, thanks for the wonderful morning.
Thank you, sir.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from the waterfront in Morro Bay.
Contributor Brian Reynolds speaks to dancer and UC Santa Barbara Professor Emeritus Tonya Shimon about her new book, The Art of Simeon Shimon. This exploration into her father's creative life has just won Tonya an Independent Press Award, the 2020 Distinguished Favorites Award in the category of Fine Arts.
Hello, this is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by Tonya Shimon, who is a professional dancer and professor, most recently Professor Emerita at the Department of Theater and Dance at UCSB. Welcome, Tonya.
Hello, thank you.
We're here today primarily to talk about your father, Simeon Shimon, artist and illustrator throughout his whole life, social activist. But what I'd like to start the interview with a little bit is sort of how you got here today, your career and how it led you to publishing this new book.
I will try to give you a fairly short story of a long story. As a child, I fell in love with dance when my parents had a party. Chinese dancers were performing. And my parents were artists, encouraged me to dance. So I had encouragement along the way during my training and a great amount of emotional support to do what I believed I wanted to do.
So your dad, tell me about him as a man and his life a little bit, if you would.
Well, he was born in Astrakhan, Russia, on the Caspian Sea. And in the book, there is a autobiography talking about these early experiences in Russia, and became an artist. Gradually, he found museums, theater, libraries on his own in New York, and he went to Cooper Union Art School briefly and was primarily self-taught through seeing great art. He was given a commission when he was in 1936, so his life had a thread of three different paths: the commercial work, where he did film posters, and he did fine art when he could. He would take trips to Europe.
I know that movie posters are a big deal. When I think of Gone with the Wind or Solomon and Sheba, those are
right.
Probably lend themselves to that kind of a spectacle. Yeah. So your dad passed a few years ago, a number of years ago. What was your motive for bringing the book out now?
I felt it was terribly important that his work not be lost, his fine art paintings not be lost, and they were not known to the general public at all. The only way to do this, in my mind, was to create a really good book.
From a mechanical point of view, how did you assemble all these materials, including copies of his work? Did you have another relative help you, or did you hire somebody? I'm just out of curiosity. That'd be a major, major job.
It's a major job. Well, it started about 30 years ago when I got the idea, when I found the pictures in my sister's house in my father's chest. A great many people helped me along the way in terms of advice. I am totally grateful to all of these people. I couldn't have done it without them. But the main haul of the work, I must say, I've been dealing with.
Well, you mentioned 30 years. I would like to remind everyone, this is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today, we are joined by dancer and now author, Tanya Shimon, a dancer with such great companies as Martha Graham and a professor emerita at the University of California at Santa Barbara. We're discussing her new book about her father's art, The Art of Simeon Shimon. It's an incredible window into another time, 30s and 40s, when the Works Progress Administration was encouraging people to not just build bridges and drain swamps, but create public art. I know one of the things about some of the public art, it wasn't without controversy. I remember reading about Diego Rivera being invited by the Rockefellers to put a mural in New York City, and it turned out it was a little too reddish politically for them, and they, I believe they covered it over, quite a controversy. But your father, it looks like he was able to do this without being proscribed or censored.
I can comment on that idea. When my father was painting the mural in Washington, he put in African-Americans in educated roles. The official there asked not to, and he did it anyway.
The official said what?
He did not want any African-Americans in the painting.
Ah.
And my father did it anyway.
Uh-huh. And he got away with it.
He did. In very educated roles.
Yes.
And he had great, great admiration and compassion for all people, and he painted his beliefs.
How much of his art and his activities were you aware of when he was still alive? Did you share with him? Did you have discussions about what he was doing and why?
Yes, he shared a lot. He spoke very freely about what he was doing and his stories about it. I knew that when he painted the mural for the next 2 years, slept during the day and painted at night.
Wow.
On the wall in the Department of Justice building. So I knew that he was very dedicated and followed his beliefs, that he wanted to do the best job he could do.
What was the time frame for that particular mural?
1936 to 1940.
Interesting. So 4 years.
Yeah, and I should mention that it was commissioned by the Public Works Arts Project, which is mm-hmm. a PWAP, not quite the WAP.
Right. Art as an end in its own self, it's so important to me, and I wish it were more important to more people, and especially our school system. I think the arts are so important. I don't want to stack it up against sports, let's say, but...
No, I agree completely. And art is absolutely essential to life. It's always been the expression of humankind.
I have to tell you that when I looked at the art and the examples that you had given me, I still don't have the book in my hands, and I would love to get a copy down the road. But
sure.
It was very inspirational. The I don't know, the colors, this is just me as the viewer, and the themes are a little bit dark, but then you look at the people's faces and how they're holding their hands, and you look at mm-hmm. the diversity. And anyway, I found it very uplifting.
Good. I'm very happy. That would make my father very happy. He was a very compassionate man.
I'd like to talk a little bit about immigration. It's such a hot button issue these days, and yet our country was built on immigration.
Right.
And it was strengthened by immigration, and it brought people like your dad and scientists. And it's not a threat. It's just the opposite. It's very enticing and very rewarding. What do you think?
I totally agree. And I feel that there should be a place for everyone together, working well, loving, and happily existing, coexisting, and sharing the beauty that's in each person and what they have to offer. That's what my father believed. He showed a lot of dignity in all mankind.
What would be your message to the public about this book and about your father and, as a man and his art?
I think that it is an immigrant story of an artist whose work reached out and touched people in all walks of life.
True.
I hope that this work becomes inspirational for people just on a personal level or on a larger level as well of what it stands for.
Well, I would urge you to, when you're ready, to do some touring, to come up here and consider our public library venues that we have,
yes.
but also the bookstores that we have. And
oh, thank you so very much. Greatly appreciated, and I will definitely make my way north.
All right. This has been Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today, we were joined by Tanya Shimon, dance professor at UCSB, professional dancer, and daughter of Simeon Shimon, who is the inspiration for her new book, The Art of Simeon Shimon. Thank you so much, Tanya.
Thank you so much.
That was Tanya Shimon talking about her new book, The Art of Simeon Shimon. The exploration into her father's creative life has just won Tanya an Independent Press Award, the 2020 Distinguished Favorites Award in the category of Fine Arts. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's at kcbx.org.